15. A girl! A girl! At last even Abramson, who had served two sentences and learned all about Charaska's the first time around, tired of murmuring. In two places whispered stories were nearing their end. Somebody was snoring loudly, horribly, sounding at times as if he was about to burst. The blue light over the four-panelled door set in the vaulted entrance shed a dim light on a dozen double bunks, fastened together in pairs and arranged fan-wise around the large semicircular room. This room, probably the only one of its kind in Moscow, was 12 good masculine strides in diameter. Up above there was a spacious dome at the base of a hexagonal tower. Around the dome there were 5 elegant arched windows. The windows were barred but not muzzled, fitted with inverted awnings, so that in daytime you could see the wilderness that passed for a park on the other side of the highway, and on summer evenings the plaintive singing of husbandless girls in a Moscow suburb troubled the prisoners' minds. Nerzhin, on the top bunk by the central window, was not even trying to sleep. Down below, Potapov, the engineer, had been sleeping the untroubled sleep of an honest working man for some time. On the next bunk to the left, the moon-faced vacuum-tube expert, Zemelya, sprawled and snuffled contentedly, with Priantchikov's empty bed beneath him, while to the right, on a bunk set right against Nerzhin's own, Ruska Daronin, one of the youngest zeks in the Sharashka, was sleeplessly tossing and turning. As the conversation in Yakonov's office receded, Nerzhin saw more and more clearly that his refusal to join the cryptographic group was not just an episode in his professional career, but the turning point in his life as a whole. It was bound to earn him, probably very soon, a long and grueling trek to somewhere in Siberia or the Arctic. It would mean death, or victory over death. He needed to think about this abrupt change of direction. What had he achieved during this 3-year breathing space in the Sharashka? Was he now tough enough to stand being tossed back into the abyss of the camps? As it happened, the following day was Gleb's 31st birthday. He did not, of course, feel like reminding his friends of it. Was he at the midpoint of his life? Near the end? Just beginning? His thoughts blurred. At one minute he found himself weakly imagining that it was not too late. He could put things right, agree to join the cryptographers. Then he began remembering his grievance, that they had kept postponing his wife's visit for 11 months now, and wondering whether they would let him see her before he left. But then his other self awoke and flexed its muscles. The breadlines of the first 5-year plan had transformed a diffident boy into a different Nerzhin, brash and defiant, and the life he had led since, especially in the camps, had left him still tougher. His sturdy inner self was already busily calculating how often he would be searched, as he left Marfino on admission to Butyrki, on admission to Krasnaya Pristina, how to conceal fragments of pencil lead in his jacket, how to smuggle his old overalls out of the Sharashka, every extra layer is precious to a working stiff, how to prove that the aluminium teaspoon he had carried around ever since he had been inside was his own, not stolen from the Sharashka, which had almost identical ones. He even felt a restless urge to get up then and there in the dim light and begin his preparations, start rearranging and hiding. All this time, Ruska Daronin kept impatiently changing his position. One minute he was lying on his stomach, burying himself in his pillow, and pulling the blanket over his head so that his feet were uncovered. The next he would be flat on his back, flinging off the blanket and exposing a white bedspread and a dingy sheet. One of the 2 sheets was changed every bath day, but by December the Sharashka had overspent its yearly soap allowance and bath day was delayed. Suddenly he sat up in bed, hoisted himself, pillow and all, up against the iron back and opened a hefty volume of Mommsen's History of Rome. Noticing that Nerzhin was awake and staring up at the blue bulb, Ruska asked in a hoarse whisper,
"Gleb, have you got any cigarettes handy? Give me one."
Ruska did not smoke as a rule. Nerzhin reached over to the pocket of his overalls, which was hanging on the back of the bunk. He took out 2 cigarettes and they both lit up. Ruska concentrated on his smoking and did not look at Nerzhin. His face, which was always changing its expression, at one moment it was naive and boyish, but the next, the face of a trickster of genius, under its mop of unruly dark blonde hair, looked attractive even in the ghastly light from the blue bulb. "Here," said Nerzhin, putting an empty Belamor pack where Ruska could use it as an ashtray. They tapped their ash into it. Ruska had been in the Sharaska since summer. Nerzhin took an immediate liking to him and felt an urge to protect him. But it was soon evident that Ruska, though only 23, and with 25 years of imprisonment hanging over him, needed no protector. His character and outlook had been fully formed by the vicissitudes of a short but turbulent life, not so much by his 4 weeks of university education, 2 in Moscow, 2 in Leningrad, as by 2 years on the run, with forged documents and the whole Soviet police force on his trail. He had sworn Gleb to absolute secrecy when he told him, and most recently by 2 years of prison. With his gift of instant mimicry, he had quickly mastered the wolfish lore of the Gulag. He was always on his guard and confided in very few people, though on the surface he was childishly candid. He was feverishly active, and tried to pack a great deal into a short time. Reading was just one of his many activities. Gleb, wearying of his muddled thoughts, was still not ready for sleep, and judged that Ruska was even less so. He whispered a question in the hushed room. "Well, how's the theory of cycles going?" They had been discussing this theory not long ago, and Ruska had meant to look for confirmation of it in Momzin. Ruska turned around at Nerzhin's whisper, but looked blank. He wrinkled his brow, struggling to make sense of the question. "I mean, how's the theory of historical cycles going?" Ruska sighed, and as he released his breath, his face and his restless mind also relaxed. He leaned sideways, shifted his weight onto his elbow, tossed his cigarette, which had gone out half-smoked, into the empty pack Nerzhin had put next to him, and said dully, "I'm sick of everything. Books and theories included." They were silent again. Nerzhin was about to turn onto his other side when Ruska gave a laugh and began whispering, gathering speed as he warmed to his subject. "History is so monotonous that it makes you sick to read it. It's as bad as Pravda. The nobler and more honourable a man is, the dirtier the treatment his fellow countrymen hand out to him. Spurius Cassius wanted to get land for the common people, and the common people let him be put to death. Spurius Melius wanted to give bread to the hungry people, was suspected of wanting to be king, and was executed. Marcus Manlius, the one who was awakened by the cackling of the geese in all the schoolbooks and saved the capital, was executed for treason. What do you think of that? You amaze me. Read enough history, and you'll want to be a villain yourself. It pays better. If it hadn't been for the great Hannibal, we would never have heard of Carthage, but the wretched place banished him, confiscated his property, and razed his dwelling to the ground. There's nothing new under the sun. All that time ago, Gnaeus Naevius was put in the stocks for writing daring plays. The Aetolians, long before we thought of it, proclaimed a false amnesty to entice emigres back home and put them to death. The Romans had already arrived at a truth that the Gulag keeps forgetting. It's uneconomic to let a slave go hungry. You must feed him. The whole of history is one unmitigated fuck-up. It's every man for himself and the devil take the hindmost. There's neither truth nor error, no progress, no future." The ghastly blue light made the disillusionment trembling on those young lips more painful to see. It was partly Nerzhin's doing that Ruska had begun to think this way, but hearing it from Ruska now made him want to protest. Among his older friends, Gleb's role was destructive criticism, but he felt some responsibility toward this young prisoner. "A word to the wise, Rostislav," he replied very quietly, leaning over so that he was almost speaking into his neighbor's ear. "However clever and ungainsayable such philosophical systems as skepticism or agnosticism or pessimism may be, you must remember that they are in their very nature condemned to impotence. They cannot govern human activity, because people cannot stand still, and so cannot do without systems that affirm something, that point to some destination. Even if the goal is a quagmire. Anywhere, just as long as we press on," Ruska retorted. "Even if..." Gleb hesitated. "Hell, I don't know. Look, I myself think that mankind has a great need of skepticism. We need it to crack open rock-hard heads, to choke fanatical throats. It is needed here more than anywhere, yet it establishes itself on Russian soil with more than usual difficulty. But skepticism cannot give a man a firm footing, and that is something he must have.
Give me another cigarette.
Ruska lit up and puffed nervously.
You know, it's a good thing the MGB didn't let me go on studying and end up as a historian.
He pronounced each word distinctly in a loud whisper.
Suppose I'd graduated and gone on to do postgraduate work like an idiot. Say I had become a scholar and maybe not a venal hack, though that's a big maybe. Say I'd written a fat book taking a fresh look, the 803rd, at ancient Novgorod's administrative system or Caesar's war with the Helvetians. There are so many cultures in the world, so many languages, so many countries, so many clever people, and still more clever books in every one of them. What sort of idiot would want to read it all? What was that quotation of yours? The conclusions arrived at by experts with such difficulty will be shown by other, still greater experts, to be illusory. Was that it?
Steady now, Nyazhin admonished him. You're cutting the ground from under your feet. You're leaving yourself nothing to aim at. We can doubt, we must doubt. But we must have something to love, don't you think?
Ruska seized on the word.
To love? Yes, something to love, he crowed. But not history, not theory, a girl.
He leaned over toward Nyazhin's bed and seized his elbow. What is the most important thing they've deprived us of, would you say?
The right to attend meetings? Politics classes? The right to subscribe to state loans? The one and only thing that the Big Chief could do to hurt us was to deprive us of women.
So that's what he has done.
For 25 years. The swine.
I wonder if anybody realizes,
he said, beating his breast,
what a woman means to a prisoner. You can go mad that way,
Nyazhin protested, but a sudden warmth welled up in him when he thought of Seema and her promise for Monday evening.
Get it out of your head,
or your mind will black out altogether.
Ah, but on Monday,
the thing that comfortable married people take for granted, but that becomes a raging, feverish animal need in a desperate prisoner.
What does Freud call it?
His voice was getting weaker as his own thoughts grew muddled.
Sublimation, that's it.
Switch your energy to other matters. Study philosophy, and you'll need neither bread nor water, nor a woman's caresses.
But he shivered as he pictured in detail what it would be like the day after tomorrow. This unbearably delicious thought robbed him of speech.
My mind is fogged already. I won't get to sleep all night. A girl. Everybody needs a girl. To hold her in your arms. To... Oh, what's the use?
Ruska carelessly dropped his cigarette onto the bedding, turned over abruptly, flopped on his belly, and tugged the blanket over his head, exposing his feet. Nyazhin grabbed the smouldering cigarette just as it was about to slip between the bunks onto Potapov down below and stubbed it out. He had recommended philosophy to Ruska as a refuge, but it was one in which he heard himself howling like a caged animal. Ruska's youth had been spent on the run with the whole Soviet police force behind him, and now prison had him in its clutches. But what about me? Gleb asked himself. What held me back when I was 17 or 19, and hot gales of passion darkened my mind? He had curbed himself, suppressed his urges, wallowed in the dialectic like a piglet burying its snout in muck, grunting and guzzling, afraid of missing something. The years before his marriage, his irrecoverable, misspent youth, were now, in prison after prison, his bitterest memory. He had been helplessly ignorant, had no idea how to relieve his fits of madness, lacked the words with which to draw someone close, the tone of voice that women yield to. He was also inhibited by an old-fashioned concern for female virtue, and there was no older and wiser woman to lay a gentle hand on his shoulder. Or rather, one such woman had called to him, and he had not understood. Later, on the floor of a prison cell, he had gone over it all in his mind, remembered that lost chance and all those wasted years, and these memories were like red-hot needles in his brain. Never mind.
Less than 48 hours to get through until Monday evening.
Gleb leaned over and whispered in his neighbour's ear.
Ruska, what about you? Is there somebody?
Yes, there is.
He spoke in a painful whisper, lying flat on his back and clutching his pillow. He was breathing into it, and the heat returned by the pillow and all the heat of his youth that was wasting away so uselessly in prison fevered the trapped young body that cried out for and had no hope of relief. He had said, "Yes, there is," and he wanted to believe that there was a girl, but what he had was something elusive, indefinable, not a kiss, not even a promise. Only the memory of how one evening a girl had listened to his stories about himself with a look of compassion and fascination, and her look had made Ruska for the first time feel that he was a hero, and his life story a remarkable one. Nothing had happened between them as yet, but enough had happened for him to say that he did indeed have a girl.
Gleb continued questioning him.
So, who is she?
Rostislav peeked from under the blanket and answered in the darkness.
It's Clara.
Clara? The prosecutor's daughter?